The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Well, we got Nick Raleigh here, and Nick and I go way, way back, all the way back 2005 at the Trial Lawyers College when I was there at the grad program, just doing whatever we were doing there. And people were like, oh, because Nick was late getting there that year. Maybe you think you were in trial or something. Like, so Nick Raleigh's to me, I didn't know you at the time, and people were just talking about you. And really, because like a few people knew you because they, you know, like your friends, like, what's our buddy from Missouri? Daryl.
Daryl Edward. Don't we miss Daryl?
Yes. He was the best guy. We ran into each other again back in 2012. We were both at the AAJ in Chicago because we hadn't seen or talked in a few years. And you showed up there and I was hanging out with Daryl because that was my first AAJ because I had this epiphany that I should become a plaintiff's lawyer. And then we connected there. And then you invite me to come to Vegas to watch you speak at Cala. I think it was maybe your first time speaking at Cala. Does this ring a bell?
But we didn't lose contact during those years. We met 19 years ago, and we never lost contact. We did trials together.
Well, but we were doing our own things, and we had to see each other a long time. And this is when, you know, you were just really starting to hit your stride as far as communicating to juries, you know what I'm saying?
And I hit my stride way before that. You just obviously you weren't paying attention. You don't have a good.
Okay, that could be true. But your stride was just striding. You did it way before. I was a witness to it, to the stride hitting. I remember, because was that Hoddick that we had in trial that you did that compilation where you said, I can make it look like anything I want that we played? Do you remember that?
I don't.
We were doing a trial and it was like, I think it was a radiologist and you'd cut up some video of him.
Oh, yeah. Was that Rothman?
Rothman, that's it.
Stephen Rothman. And I had a video of him talking to the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And he was saying, listen, I can make a $1 million case for any of you with my MRI scanner. I can show films and tell a jury anything, and they're going to believe me. Rothman. Thereafter, Dr. Rothman, a neuroradiologist, he's passed since. But I never had any problems cross-examining him after that. He was doing some bad work for the defense, but he never gave me any trouble after that day. And I cross-examined him probably 15 to 20 times in my career.
It's good that you got him in line there with that one video compilation. It was an interesting experience because it was very creative. That was caused a little bit. I remember it was crazy, like an uproar. Like,
oh, yeah.
It all worked out well. But anyway, so Nick, you got a lot going on these days. You're down in Costa Rica. Aren't you in the middle of a trial right now?
Oh, we picked a jury in Seattle via Zoom from Costa Rica. And we have to spend a few more days picking that jury. Then we'll have openings on May 20th.
All right. And that trial is about what?
That trial is about Monsanto poisoning America's public schools with PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, which are a forever chemical, one of 11 that have been outlawed in every country in the world. They're bad. You have them in you. I have them in me. We all have them in us. They exist everywhere in the environment. Most animals and birds have PCBs in them. It's a horrible, horrible toxin. And Monsanto knew about that in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, lied about it, covered it up, falsified science, did fake research, published fake scientific publications, convinced the public and the government that there was nothing to worry about. And now it's PCBs are coming out of the cracks of caulking in schools, light ballasts in schools, and people are getting sick. They're developing cancer. People are dying. Children are starting puberty early. It's a neurotoxin also. So people are suffering brain damage. This is way bigger and way beyond Roundup.
This PCBs, because like you were just telling me about how big it is.
Yep.
And talking about, I know that you in Vegas this year, that you are going to get together with a couple of your folks that you prosecute these cases with to do do an education presentation, help them understand what's going on in these lawsuits. So tell us what you have in store along those lines.
Sure. We're going to put on a half day or full day program in addition to the full trial by human program that will exist and take place within Trial Lawyers University in October. So we'll be putting on trial by human and also doing a couple other programs when you give us time, whether it's 3 hours or 6 hours in a day, to present on some additional topics. One of those will be PCB litigation and how to slay the dragon. How to take a case against Monsanto, pursue it, work it for years and win. And PCBs exist everywhere in the country. They're in one third of America's public schools is what our estimation is. These cases are everywhere and people need help. But in order to help the people that need help, lawyers have to learn how to do these cases. And we would love to teach them because we can't do them all. Handling a PCB case, you could handle a handful of them within one firm. So we need other firms to be weaponized to go into battle against Monsanto.
And who are you going to be presenting this with in Vegas on the PCBs?
We have different trial teams. This is mass tort litigation that's going on in Seattle. So maybe we'll get Henry Jones there. Maybe we'll get Colleen or Ken Friedman. Definitely Courtney and I. Maybe we'll get Rick Friedman to come down. We're still figuring that out, but Keith Bruno, Teresa Bowen-Hatch, who both tried a case with Mike Wampold and his amazing partners. We've got a lot of people who have a lot to say about PCBs. So we'll put on a dynamic program.
All right. And then the 3 days of trial by human, you know, because you've been at both of the first two TLU Vegas conferences in 2021 and 2022, just in spite of your distaste for this city, which I get.
It's not the city, it's the casinos. It's the smoke, it's the air, it's the environment, it's the drinking, it's the partying, it's the culture of our profession. We want to change. And the reason why we're coming is to try to help save some people or to provide a healthy alternative to what others are doing. So we'll have pre-planned meals that are very healthy. We're going to have a gym. We're going to have a cold plunge, probably an infrared sauna. We're going to have a whole program within TLU that feeds people, that helps people leave TLU with a better mind, body, and spirit. So you're going to be able to actually sign on and become part of a wellness program within Trial Lawyers University. And hopefully that's something that you'll move forward with and do on your own. We'll set it up, set up the framework, because again, we're not big fans of going to Las Vegas because of the environment and where these seminars take place. I do love the Vegas shows though.
I actually agree with you about the distractions of the casinos and the nightclubs and the drinking. And unfortunately, I try to tell people what to do, but not everybody listens to me. I tell them it's not in their best interest. But that's why I'm excited about Huntington. I'm super excited about Huntington Beach because there's no casinos, there's no gambling, there's no nightclubs. The nightclub is within a hotel because we have the entire hotel.
With your nightclubs, are you? My back hurts. I jumped off a 70-foot cliff into the water the other day. And
that might do it for you.
Send you the video. It was pretty cool, but it hurt.
You can show us the video if you really have it.
At these events, what we would like to have is a mocktail station. Maybe we could help you set that up. So there's an alternative to drinking alcohol.
Yeah, I drink water. That's my alternative. But hey, whatever, but we can do whatever we want.
People don't, they're not just sitting there with water looks uncool. They want to have something else.
We got to be cool. This is very true.
We try so hard, don't we?
Sometimes. I want to ask you, actually, I didn't even know this question. I've known you for a long time. When did you know or when did you decide, hey, I want to be a lawyer? What was the influence that caused that?
Well, I was quite a juvenile delinquent. I was always kicked out of every school that I went to from the fourth grade through high school.
Wait, just tell us, how many schools did you get kicked out of?
Okay. Fourth grade one, fifth grade two, sixth grade two. So one, two,
five,
seventh, two, eighth grade, two, ninth grade, one, 10th grade, one, 11th grade, two. So I guess what's that? 18.
You went to 13 schools in that amount of time.
Well, when you get kicked out of one school, you go to another, right? I don't know if I did the math right.
Well, you are the most kicked out of school trial lawyer probably in the country.
I'm going to do it again. Okay. So fourth grade, I was kicked out. right? Fifth grade, I was kicked out of two schools. Sixth grade, I was kicked out of two schools. Seventh grade, I was kicked out of two schools. So I've kicked out of one, then you go start somewhere else, right?
Upward seven.
All right. Now we're to eighth grade, two schools. Ninth grade, one school. 10th grade, one school. 11th grade, two schools. So what was that?
Got it right. First guess. See, I can do math. Very simple math.
Well, and you got to count summer school and driver's ed. I was kicked out of driver's ed both years.
Well, you're up to 16. All right. So you had a little trouble with authority. Just a little bit.
Just a bit. Actually, what I really had trouble with was kids bullying other kids. I had been bullied and I got to a point where I could stand up for myself and I would be filled with rage and anger when I saw other kids getting picked on. So most of the time I was kicked out of school for fighting, usually fighting kids that were picking on other kids or that were just bullies, you know, and then they decided to say something to me. And
after getting kicked out of school, you finally graduated from high school.
I graduated from a school for delinquents where you just had to read a book and take a test. I was really good at taking tests and really good at absorbing information, learning at my own pace, at a very fast pace, actually, which is one reason why school didn't work for me. School was boring. Like the teacher would get up and teach something. I'd say, okay, I got it. And then they'd keep teaching it. And I'd be messing around or doodling or doing something else.
All right. And so, but you graduated from your alternative high school.
I did. And I went into the U.S. military. That was really my option. Because there was no way I was going to get into college. I didn't have a family that was going to help me with college in any way, shape, or form. I grew up very poor, homeless at times. You know, was buying my own food and clothing as a kid, moving from place to place, completely out on my own at the age of 15. So the military was the way.
So tell us the military. I know that, you know, that's where you met Jacob Norman, who's your partner now, but tell us about how your military service, you think, helped shape you into the trial lawyer you are today.
Sure. It's discipline and it's a reward-based system, really. You work hard and you go up in rank, you get recognized, you know what the work is, they lay it out for you. It's very strict and everybody's an equal. The other thing is rather than people picking on each other, people are working to help each other. The military was a wonderful experience for me, and that's why my three oldest sons are all in the military.
How many years did you serve?
Six in total.
And that was in the Army?
First in the Air Force, just like Jacob, then in the Army.
You met Jacob Norman, who's a buddy of mine that actually used to help me run my old program, Trial by Human, Trojan Horse.
He did. And then he came over to Trial by Human.
You had a little bit, you know, more structure.
But look at how we're all doing this. We're just coming back together and things.
It's all an evolution of who we are and what we're thinking.
So I wanted to become a trial lawyer when I was young, but I never thought I would be able to. I never thought I'd be able to go to school and get the right education. Jerry Spence represented Randy Weaver. For those out there that are young, look up Ruby Ridge. Randy Weaver was got in a shootout with the feds, is the long and the short of it. And the feds were in the wrong, but this was all over the news. There were three things that were all over the news where video cameras were like live streaming what was going on. There was the O.J. Simpson chase. There was Waco. There was Ruby Ridge. So everybody thought that Randy Weaver was in the wrong, right? That he's the one that started this with the feds. Jerry Spence came in to represent him. And we knew Randy Weaver in our hometown as somebody who was always getting into trouble in one way, shape, or form. I'd see him at the barbershop growing up, Farrell's Barbershop. My stepdad, who was very much a dad to me, you know, knew who he was because my dad was a sheriff in the neighboring town and had to deal with Randy. I think he arrested him a few times. So this is going on and it's all over the news. And Jerry Spence comes on to TV and he's representing Randy Weaver. He got Randy Weaver acquitted and then pursued a civil case on behalf of Randy Weaver's children and won that civil case and got millions of dollars for his daughters who had their man killed. So I started following Jerry Spence and my grandmother, who passed away in her 90s. You know, we come from a small town in Iowa, and she was a nurse. Her husband was a farmer. She would take out clips from the newspaper whenever, you know, anything was in there about Jerry Spence. She gave me a a couple of his books. So I followed Jerry Spence, and I thought someday maybe I could go to law school. But I thought you had to have a pre-law degree. So I was in, I was actually doing a survival training course with the U.S. Army when we were in the mountains. And one of my fellow soldiers was up all night on what they'd call like fire duty, right? There's a fire, you know, anyone invades your camp. So we had to stay up all night, and we talked that night, and we talked about what we were going to do in our life. And he said, I'm going to law school. I said, wow. I said, what did you get your pre-law degree in? And I had a bachelor's at that time. And he said, what are you talking about? There's no such thing as a pre-law degree. So I, really? He goes, yeah. He goes, you have a bachelor's, right? I said, I do. He goes, all you have to do is take the LSAT. I said, what's the LSAT? And when we finished our training, we had some days off, and he actually printed out a copy of the form that you fill out to take the LSAT. So he brought it to me, and he goes, here, fill this out and send it in. So I did, and ended up going to law school.
Where was your law school?
I went to University of Laverne, which was it was accredited by the California State Bar, but not ABA accredited. I'd been accepted at some ABA schools, but I didn't know what an ABA school was. I just decided I wanted to go to law school somewhere that was warm, and there was an Army unit that would take me out in California. So I started law school in California, and it was the second year of law school. I was doing a Fleming's Fundamentals of Law course, where you learn how to take the test for specific subjects that you're studying. And I was sitting next to this girl, still remember to this day, and we were talking. And she goes, what are you going to do after law school? And I said, oh, I'm going to go back home to Iowa and probably be a small town lawyer. And she goes, you can't. You can only practice in California because your school isn't an ABA school. Again, this is my second year of law school. I looked at her, I'm like, what's an ABA school? What are you talking about? Stormed into the administration office the following week. And I said, what the heck? You know, I told you guys I'm from Iowa and I want to go back and practice in Iowa. And they're like, whoa, you just have to apply and take the bar. And we have other lawyers who went to school here who practice in different states. But it's really not that easy. I had to wait 5 years practicing in California to be able to get licensed in Iowa. Now I'm licensed, you know, in many states, kind of all over, and getting licensed in more states. And I've appeared, let's see, in almost every state in this country on a case. And I've tried cases in about half of the states in the country. So it worked out, but I went to University of Laverne, and it was actually a really great education. You know, there are a lot of great lawyers that came out of that school.
Yeah. It's like law school, as we all know, is just part of the process. Doesn't really matter what you do in there.
Yeah.
Nothing you learn in there is any relevance. I don't think it's even relevant to taking the bar exam because you forget it all. So you got to restudy shit. It's only about passing the bar exams, not about practicing law. That's crazy.
You tell me that you went to Harvard or Stanford or Yale. It's like, well, that's awesome. You worked hard and got some good grades and got into those great schools, but it doesn't mean a darn thing about what type of lawyer you're going to be. It's not an indicator at all. In fact, what I've seen a lot of the time is that these lawyers, they think they're elite and they go to these elite law firms and you get into trial against these folks and like, you got to be kidding me. This is what an Ivy League education gives you, makes you think you're elite. Now, there's some really great lawyers out there that went to elite law schools, like Johnny Cochran went to Harvard.
Really?
Yeah.
That's impressive. I didn't know that.
But Jerry Spence went to the University of Wyoming.
And he failed the bar a couple of times, so it made me feel better about my multiple failures. So, Nick, after you get your bar card, are you in the Army while in law school?
I am, yes. And then right the last year, I got out. I went into the military when I was 17 years old, my 17th birthday, and I did work with the Air Force before I shipped. And I shipped, I think that was October 14th. That's when Jacob Norman and I first met. We went to basic training, what people would call boot camp together. And then let's see, I got out, it would have been 94. Yeah, I got out and right at the end of 2000. And then I graduated from law school. I finished law school the end of 2001. And then I took the February bar in 2002. And I passed, sworn in as a lawyer in May of 2002.
All right.
Almost 22 years of practicing law. But I got certified as a law student while I was in law school and got a lot of courtroom experience as a certified law student. Did my first trials as a law student.
For the prosecutor's office, for the public defenders, for civil lawyers?
Civil plaintiff's lawyers.
Really?
I hit the ground running when I got out of law school. Most of the med mal defense attorneys knew who I was in Southern California. I'd handled cases against most of them.
Right. You used to work for Brian Brandt for a little while, didn't you?
Sure did. I was certified as a lawyer under Brian Brandt. We did cases together. He was great. He's still a great friend. Brian Brandt, I wanted to work for him. Like, my whole goal was to practice with Brian Brandt. Like, I was bringing in my own cases at that point. I was moving and shaking. And I was up, he'd have me up for dinner at his house. We'd go on runs together. He was a really great mentor. He always told me to calm down, calm down, calm down. His dad was a lawyer. His brother was, who's not with us anymore, Brendan, was a really phenomenal lawyer. But Brian, when I passed the bar and came and I swore in, I said, all right, let's talk. And I wanted my name on the door. I said, well, how long is it going to be? If I come in, then I get a piece of the action, a piece of what I win. And he's like, no, that's not how it works. No. You'll get a salary and you'll get it like a discretionary bonus and we'll work it out. And I said, well, how many years? Like, I'm trying cases. How many years till I get my name on the door? And I couldn't get a straight answer from him. And then he told me, he goes, for most people, it takes 10 years to become a junior partner. And then it takes this many years. That is not going to work for me. So I didn't end up. All I wanted to do was work with Brian Brandt.
Amazing the way the universe works out.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, he's still a great, great friend. But I was running at a very fast pace and clawing my way up the cliff to succeed. I can't really explain what the motivation was. To me, it was just life or death. I worked nonstop. I'd sleep in my office in a sleeping bag. I was broke when I started practicing law. I had bad credit. You know, I was in debt. I found something that I was finally good at. I was a good medic. I was good at anything I ever did when it came to work, but I was good in a courtroom and it felt wonderful to be good at something. So I wanted as much of that as I possibly could. And I know that I didn't love myself very much, but being in a courtroom, being able to stand up for people who aren't being treated the right way, who are being bullied, gave me purpose. And then winning for those people felt wonderful. And I was winning for them and beating these bullies and not getting kicked out of school for it.
That's great.
And I was getting paid for it. It's like, this is the best job in the world. This is amazing.
It isn't.
That guy down, that piece of shit, and the way he's treating this wonderful person, and I get to knock them with a big verdict and I get paid for it.
This is a great job. When people like piss on it and like, oh, being a lawyer sucks.
Right. What are you talking about?
Like, why? It's the greatest thing ever. There's no heavy lifting. It's all intellectual. And if you're good, you can make a really nice living and it's fun and every day's different and you're doing things that are important every day. And it's always challenging because it's a constant battle between, for you, it's you and the other side. For me, it's me against doing my conference and stuff. It's a lot going on. It's a lot of organizational stuff that I have to kind of grow into and learn how to do it. Because if I don't do it really well at a high level, it's not going to be very good and people aren't going to have that much fun and learn that much. So my energy is focused on this right now, but working on transitioning back to be the trial lawyer. That's kind of my goal.
You should. I've tried cases with you, Dan. You're good in a courtroom. You won a lot of very difficult cases. I remember some of the criminal defense cases that you did, pro bono work that you did, and acquittals you got for people that were wrongfully accused or being overly prosecuted. You did great work as a trial lawyer. That's where you and I first bonded. The work we do, what happens or what has happened to the clients, the people that we represent, is usually a generational injury. It's what happens to them and the way they've been wronged doesn't just impact them. It impacts their family, their children, right?
Yeah.
So what we do is we come in and we try to bring balance and restore whatever can be restored, whether it's compensation, whatever it is, getting that person's quality of life changed, their family's quality of life changed. So we are coming in to make a generational impact in a positive way on people's lives who've been generationally damaged. It's really important work. And the corporate America and the insurance companies, and the medical lobbies, they want to stop us. They want to stop us so that they can continue to get away with inflicting generational harm on the people in this country. It's awful. So we need trial lawyers. We need those lawyers who are out there complaining about practicing law and saying they don't like it to become trial lawyers so they can have a purpose in their life. Because if they don't like practicing law, it's because they're not practicing the right type of law.
Right.
A lot of those people I hear are working for the defense, working for the dark side.
Can't even imagine that job, like not having a client. Nobody really cares. And you got to bill hours every day and you're micromanaged by some corporate hack. I really have empathy for those defense lawyers.
I feel bad for them. There are some really, really good friends I have on the defense side. And there are some that really do great work for us. They work hard to make sure that their clients, the insurance companies, listen to them and settle cases when it's appropriate and take responsibility. There are some nice people on the defense side. And then there are some who are nice people and they've been put into a mold where they're forced to do bad things because their income, you know, the bread they put on their table depends on it.
Yeah. That would not be a pleasant role to be in. But when you first get your bar card, Brian is not making you a partner.
Yeah. Which, Brian, if you're out there, that was a bad decision, my friend.
Yeah. I think everybody, it's like not investing in Google in 1999. Somebody said, I got this idea. You want to put 50 grand into it? Only be worth a 10 years later, but
all I wanted was a $10,000 a month base and get cases to try. That's it.
These are decisions that help you put in a position. Decisions are probably better for you. And so you don't get worked with Brian. So where do you start out?
So I start out working at a firm called Patterson, Rittner, Gartner, and Jurich, which was a med mal defense firm. But I was allowed, I worked under Wild Bill Rittner, who passed last year, who was another mentor of mine. His son, Rod, is a partner of mine in Trial Lawyers for Justice, who lives in Iowa. But they allowed me to take as many non-MedMal plaintiff's cases as I wanted. And any MedMal case against Kaiser, since Kaiser wouldn't send the law firm any business. I had a caseload of about, 40 to 50 cases within a year, year and a half. And I was making money for the firm, for the clients. I was doing well. And Bill Rittner called me in and said, hey, the firm's probably going to be splitting up. When I retire and Clyde Lockwood retires, Patterson's dead. You know, the other partners don't like each other. So the firm's going to split up. So you should take your cases, go out on your own, keep all the attorney's fees, reimburse us for any costs that we put into the cases. And we don't need anything back other than our costs, but promise that you'll take Rod with you when the firm splits up. I said, deal. So I took my cases and I started a little law firm called Rowley and Rinaldelli with my good friend from law school who did family law. So he did family law and I did the civil plaintiff's cases, the personal injury, medical malpractice, wrongful death. And I did some family law trials and some family law work begrudgingly. I didn't want to, but I'd have to. Family law brings in kind of the bread and butter, but then you're stuck with the case for 3 or 4 years. So after a couple of years of that, Danny and I split up in a nice way. He's focusing on family law and I want him to switch and start doing the type of work that I'm doing. And it just, I was back living in Iowa with my family. It was after I'd gone to the trial lawyers college and I opened up my own firm, which shortly evolved into Trial Lawyers for Justice. Then I was a partner in a firm in California, Carpenter, Zuckerman and Rowley at the time. Currently it's Carpenter and Zuckerman. Had a great 12 years handling my California cases with them.
You were a partner for 12 years?
Yeah, 12 years. But Trial Lawyers for Justice was a separate firm that did all the out of state, all the cases out of California, out of state cases. And that firm has been in existence since 2007.
All right. And then when did you formally just no longer be part of CZR? So went back to CZ and are you just the Trial Lawyers for Justice a couple years ago?
It'll be 3 years in October.
Okay. That's Lance, our friend. Remember Lance Berenger?
Oh my God. He's great. There's so many great lawyers over there, you know, who I love and care about. And they're all doing great.
Lance is actually, he did my Trojan Horse program way long ago, back in 2015, but he's actually coming to.
Because I sent him. I said, go do this.
But he's coming to the first thing. He's coming to the boot camp training that I'm doing June 2nd, 3rd, and 4th in Huntington Beach before the 4-day TLU Huntington Beach. So it's going to be like my first rendition of a 7-day like trial college where people really learn the physical skills of performance and presentation, you know, the eye contact, controlling their facial expressions, their hand movements, their voice, slowing it down, using visuals, getting juries to look where they want them to look, those little things that are really important. And I'm super excited because Lance, you know, he's such a student of the game and works so hard. Oh, that guy works hard.
He does. He needs to try more cases because he's really good. He has the ingredients to be a really great trial lawyer someday. Yeah. I think he is a great trial lawyer. And you have Pej Ben Cohen, who's phenomenal, Robert Ungen, who's phenomenal over there. And they've been getting great results, all of them.
Yeah, Pej is actually going to do a presentation at CRPS at Huntington Beach.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know him that well, but I'm looking forward to getting to know him better.
Should. He's a really great guy.
Yeah. I want to shift gears for a second with you, Nick. You did this Trial by Human, and you wrote several books. And the first one was Trial by Human. Is that right? And so Trial by Human is not just a book, but it's also your community, your listserv, and these live conferences that you do. So tell us about Trial by Human and what it's all about.
It's a program that you can attend. We do what trial lawyers college would call regional seminars. We do our own little, you know, seminars. Sometimes they're one-day seminars, sometimes they're Friday, Saturday, Sunday seminars. And then we do 1 or 2 weeks in the summer in Montana. You show up and we get you on your feet. I think we do things a little different than the other programs because the other programs are all teaching wonderful things. So we want to do it a little bit different. I tell people, I say, listen, any program that's out there, you should do it because you're going to learn something different from other teachers than what you're going to learn from me. So that's what you and I did, Dan. We did everything, anything that was out there. We did it. We tried to absorb everything like sponges.
There's a lot to learn. Exciting to learn.
Yeah, you have to be committed to it. But Trial by Human, we do breathing. We were just at our program in Santa Barbara.
I know, I have insights on it. I was gonna talk about it. When you breathe, when you were practicing the breathing, then I was going to be my turn and say, yeah, I was just there in Santa Barbara. It was such a great time and a great event. And I got to see so many of my friends there because people that go to programs and train, they go to different programs and train. And so it was good to see. And I haven't been a student or any sat anywhere near like a student in a while of somebody else's type of workshop. So it was it was great for me just to be, I just love being around trial lawyers. I wasn't teaching there. I was just fly on the wall as a student for maybe about an hour, a couple of hours present, but it was so great. And people, the community and people, you know, working on their cases, thinking about their cases, come up with new ideas and just having fun with each other was really such a unique experience. So I know you got one coming up. Besides what we're going to do in Vegas, right? You got something coming up in Montana.
Oh, well, first we have Trial by Human program May 30th, 31st, and June 1st in Iowa, in Des Moines, at Fort Des Moines. So you can sign up for that. And then we have a program in Montana. That'll be the second week of August. And then we have October Trial Lawyers University.
So where do people go if they want to get more information or to sign up for these programs?
I think it's trialbyhuman.com. You can Google. I'm not really involved with the marketing or how to sign up. I'd have to Google it and figure it out myself.
All right. Well, hopefully the people that are listening to this with their advanced doctorate degrees, they can figure it out.
You can email me. You can email me. I'm easy to.
TL4J.com or
NCR@TL4J.com.
All right. Then they'll figure it out. There we go. So we have the Trial by Human. That was your first book. I know that you wrote that with your friend, Steve Halterman, is that right?
Halterman, yeah. And that book was really about my experiences up to that point in time, how I had become a successful trial lawyer. I talked about the things I had done to become a successful trial lawyer, the lessons I had learned, the mistakes I've made, the failures, right? I talked as openly as I could about who I was and how I came to be who I was at the time. I'm working on a manuscript now called The Path to Verdict. It'll probably be published in 3.5 years. My plan is to publish it by the time I'm 50. So I'm 46 and a half right now. And that will really go through my journey from Trial by Human, maybe going back a little further, looking at it from a perspective that's a bit different because I have more experience and more wisdom. I look back now at some of the things I would do 10, 12 years ago. And I say, whoa, I do that way differently now. Also, people, our country, politics, everybody's evolving. Everybody's changing. So the way I talk to jurors now is a bit different than the way I talked to them 15 years ago. What worked then isn't necessarily going to work now. Different juries are going to decide things differently and be impacted differently by different arguments and different pieces of evidence. The Brutal Honesty podcast, which people will be able to find on Spotify, on YouTube, on actual, when you search for an Apple podcast, there's a little app. That's where you will find the Brutal Honesty podcast. And that should be released for the first time, first episode, 2 weeks from now. In the Brutal Honesty podcast, we're going to talk about things that most podcasts don't talk about, that most people don't talk about. Really peel back the layers of the onion and get down deep into who I am, who the different guests on the show are. We're going to talk about not just wins, we're going to talk about losses and how we can take, and this is something that I'm going to talk about at Trial Lawyers University when I do my Zoom appearance in June, taking fear and turning it into fuel. I hope that the Brutal Honesty podcast will be something very cutting edge that will help a lot of people. That's why I'm doing it.
Well, I look forward to hearing it, and I'm sure it will. And the whole fear thing is an interesting topic, fear to fuel, because I just look back on before I did the event in 2022, when I signed that contract in 2021 around Christmas time, I was terrified because it was so much money, you know what I mean, for the space that it was freaking me out. And I just had to refocus my mind and be grateful for the challenge that was ahead of me and stop letting negative shit cloud my brain, where it's like, we can choose what we think about. We can choose what we focus on. And if we allow ourselves to, we can focus on fear and insecurity and failure and doubt, but that doesn't serve, I mean, that will serve you in a negative way. Or we can just like, okay, I got this challenge. This is going to be a chance to see what I'm made of. And I know it's like, sure, become something better on the other side by pushing myself super hard. Just like when people, you know, it's the same thing when people do trials, especially trials with areas they're not familiar with. Like when you did your first PCB trial with, you know, Rick and your wife and everybody, it's like, it's a new challenge, whole new set of materials to learn and arguments to make. And when you're doing things for the first time, the odds of not having the success you want go up greatly because we have these things called learning. And so, but that's a great, I'm looking forward to the Zoom in. Maybe the judge recognizes the importance of the mission and says, you know what, we'll give you an extra day off, Mr. Rowley, to go visit in person, but we'll see.
And if the judge does, or I don't have a witness that day, Dan, I'll fly in.
All right.
There, and then I'll fly back the same night. I'll do that.
Figure it out. We'll figure that out.
The only reason I won't be is because we have that Monsanto trial.
Oh, I know. And you'll be taking a few days off before that to go to Iowa to do your trial by human.
Yeah, I'm going to finish court on Thursday night, fly to Iowa, be there for two nights and fly right back to Seattle.
Yeah, that's a big commitment. Let's talk about your other book, though, because one of the, I think probably your most, could be your most impactful, most popular book is Running with the Bulls. I always hear lawyers telling me, oh, I wrote a Running with the Bulls letter all the time. The Running with the Bulls. I sent that Running with the Bulls letter and I got paid. But so when you're running with the Bulls, what was the motivation to write that book?
I do think that book has helped people more than anything else that we've written. Damages Evolved is the newest book, and that's helping a lot of folks. And wow, what a great honor it was to write a book with Artemis and David Ball and my wife, Courtney. That's, talk about a dream come true, right? You and I were studying David Ball, you know, back 20 years ago.
I have the book, just so you know.
Huge milestone. Well, it's going to be an audiobook and David's actually reading it.
Really?
Yeah. And his voice is just an amazing voice to listen to. I can't listen to my own voice very long. But Running with the Bulls was a book I wrote because I wrote. We had other contributing authors and Courtney wrote the book with me. But it was my idea. And I said, we got to write this book. So many lawyers out there don't know how to actually get their cases settled for the full value, for the full amount that they should be getting for their clients. And they're leaving money on the table all the time. They're getting ignored by the defense lawyers. They're talking to the wrong people. They're not sending the right messages. They just don't know how to present a good case, you know, by way of a settlement opportunity letter. That's an update to Running with the Bulls. We do not call them demand letters anymore. We don't demand anything. It's too demanding. Nobody likes to hear the word demands, even in mediations, you know, the handful that I go to every year, I'll say, what's your demand? I said, I have no demand, but I have a settlement opportunity to present. Doesn't that just sound better? Doesn't it feel better? It really does. If I'm demanding something of you, you're going to say, you know what? Go pound sand. Screw you. I could demand anything of me, right? And then if I demand something of you and you say, no, we're adversaries. We're against each other. But let me provide you instead. Let me provide you with an opportunity, a fair, reasonable opportunity to resolve this case. Please consider it. There are some consequences if you don't that I have to lay out, but here's the opportunity and the choice is yours. Doesn't that feel better?
It does feel better. It's better than saying, you know what? You're staring down the nose of a 12-gauge shotgun. I got one question for you. You want both barrels or is one going to be enough? See, that's adversarial right there.
Very adversarial. That's
very adversarial. What you said is much more, let's collaborate, see what the right number is, what justice dictates. I think that's a better approach.
And I have been on the other end of the barrel of a shotgun.
That was for a long time, wasn't that? You're
staring down it, yeah.
No, but I mean, it seemed like for some time before this newer evolution, you would be the guy with the shotgun. You'd be like, oh, I'm about to blow it off, so just give me the money that you owe me, and I won't hurt you.
And that worked, and it worked well. And running with the bulls really gives lawyers the courage, I hope, that they need to find within themselves and gives them tools, shows them how to present a case. I can't even count the number of lawyers that have come up to me or that have called or emailed, reached out and said, running with the bulls changed my career, changed my practice. And look what I'm doing for people, you know, giving me examples. It's awesome to hear. At some point, I will write a update to it. Courtney and I will write an update to it.
I was thinking about your book on the one you have coming up in 3.5 years. Perhaps we could schedule it. We could do, because like Sean Claggett and John Campbell are doing a book launching party. They're jury ball on big data. So they're doing a book launching party at TLU Huntington Beach, but that'd be just the warm up.
I wrote a blurb and a recommendation for that. I'm going to see if I can find it. Let's see. Okay. I'm going to read what I wrote, which you'll find in the book. So this is about jury ball, and it is a great book. I had the honor and privilege of being able to read it before it gets published. Courtney's quote, we wrote it together. For those of you who have watched The Mandalorian or will watch The Mandalorian, the first three words, this is the way. Hopefully you'll get that. Here we go. This is the way, a cutting edge must read for every trial lawyer. Jury ball is different than anything shared before. We express gratitude to the Campbells and Claggetts for years of commitment to making justice better and for publishing revolutionary, extraordinary science. We started working with the Campbells because of the Claggetts years ago and have been amazed. Every case is different, but we'll never truly know what is unique and most important unless we do the work to find out. We especially love the chapter on wives' tales and the way this book teaches us how there should never be any set rule about what to do, how to do it, and which jurors we should trust. It's a good book.
I'm looking forward to it. Coming to Huntington Beach can get the first copies off the press, probably get some of those authors to sign them, because Claggett's been fired up about this for a couple of years. It's his first book, so you know, I'm sure the first one's always seems tougher because so many things that are doing that you're not used to.
The neat thing about the fact that they're self-publishing it is they will know who gets a book. So no one from the defense bar is going to get that book. You can't get online and buy that book, I hope. I think they're tracking it. Campbells and the Claggetts are very smart.
They are very smart. There's no doubt about that. And pretty good lawyers, too.
Good people.
And Sean and his firm are going to host a golf outing for 144 of his closest friends on October 16th. And you're going to do something for some of your closest friends, hopefully, out in the desert that has more along the lines of your philosophy on life.
Yeah, we're going to do epic hike and maybe some yoga, red rocks.
Yeah, how about... just like throwing it out there, but maybe some psychedelics too. Who knows? Depends where we are in our journey.
What are you talking about, Dan Ambrose?
Because you're out in the desert that people do stuff like that. I've heard about that happening. That's all. Anything, it's all within whatever people's journey.
I think doing things to open the mind and the soul, if they're done medicinally, are very important.
And it's small doses. It's always helpful.
Absolutely. As long as it's within the bounds of the law.
Absolutely. Always with the law.
Yes.
So you have one more book that we didn't talk about, and that is the book you wrote with your Courtney again and your trial consultant on voir dire and opening statement. I can't remember her name.
Yeah, Wendy Saxon.
Tell us a little bit about that book and what was behind writing it.
Can't count how many juries we've picked with Wendy. You know, she's amazing. She has the experience of picking thousands of juries. And we wrote a book to really show people how to start their case. Because if you start a case right, flowing through and ending it is going to be much easier. The idea was to write a book, and we've talked about it with some different co-authors, is to write a book about presentation of the evidentiary portion of your case, and then a separate book on closing and rebuttal. But what we'll probably do is have evidence, closing, and rebuttal all tied as one. So there's a second part to that book. We just done a lot of talking about it, but we haven't put it in motion yet.
You know, it's interesting the way you divided that book is kind of how we divided our webinar on your last verdict, because in that verdict, we talked about the big data. I mean, on the last webinar we did, I think it was just half ago with Claggett, you guys talked about the big data and we went through some of the voir dire and then a lot, like 90% of the actual opening from the case. And then once we get a moment after your Monsanto trial, perhaps we can finish up the process of looking at your directs and crosses and closing in the context of that motorcycle trial.
I think what you could do is set it in the evening while I'm in the trial, the Monsanto case, and we might have time over the next few weeks to record a second session. But, you know, there are other people. There's Katie and Karen and Lee that can jump on and we can get through that trial, because it might take a few sessions to really break that down. And then get me back on there when it's time for cross-exam and the closing argument.
I'll work with the TL4J team to get that put together while you're up there.
You have my blessing to get it done, because sitting there and listening to the sound of my own voice, I couldn't tolerate it after however many hours we spent.
It was 3.5 hours, so it was a while. So it was pretty in depth. But actually, I want to talk a little bit more about that case, because that was that was your last trial, wasn't it?
It was.
And that was the first trial that was ever televised in Indiana, as far as I know.
The first time a video camera was allowed in the courtroom for a trial.
It's so great when the cameras get inside the courtroom. I wish there was a camera in New York right now so people could really see, you know, and judge the testimony and the evidence for themselves.
Yep.
Unfortunately, people are deprived of that and they have to rely on secondhand, which is not nearly as compelling as listening to witnesses and seeing them cross and hearing the tone of their voice and making judgments ourselves. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about trial in the context of that case, though, because that case, tell us a little bit about that trial.
Sure. So there's an F-250 truck that says Tesla on each side of it because it is owned by Tesla. It is a Tesla maintenance F-250 driven by a Tesla employee. Tesla hauls its cars around when they need to be serviced or exchanged on a flatbed. This is the truck that pulls the flatbed. On the morning of, I think it was the 17th of April in 2017. Anyhow, it was April of 2017. There's no trailer that had been dropped off the night before. And the Tesla employee is making a left-hand turn, a dangerous left-hand turn that he should not have been making. But other people make it and they do it all the time. Tesla pointed that out during the trial. So he's making a left-hand turn across traffic, two lanes of traffic that have the right of way to get into a gas station. And a motorcyclist makes a right-hand turn to head in the direction it would have been westbound on Rockville Road. And he makes a right, and the truck makes a left and broadsides him. That's the case.
And the truck, its defense was they couldn't see the motorcyclist because it was obstructed by another vehicle in front of it, or the sun was in their eyes. And the guy was what we call trying to shoot the gap. At least according to the animation I saw, he was already taking off before the vehicle that was kind of obstructing his view of the motorcycle, before it even passed by him, he's already on the gas.
The Tesla employee gunned it to make that left-hand turn. He shot a gap between that passing truck and the next. It was a red car that was right behind the white truck in the number one lane. So yeah, he shot the gap, didn't see the motorcyclist, and didn't see him even after he hit him. Didn't see him until he got out of the truck. And that's because when he was making his left-hand turn, he was looking to the right, looking for the oncoming vehicles.
Right.
Wasn't paying attention. And our motorcyclist, according to even our own experts, was pulled out at a moment in time where he was not visible to the left turning truck and pulled out at a rate of speed that's 90 to 95% faster than any other person on the roadway. So he got dinged to the tune of 30% for that.
And on that one, just to give us a little bit more context before we discuss it, like, what was your client's injuries?
A very severe traumatic brain injury, and his left foot, half of it was amputated.
And there were cells. Did he have some cervical, like brachial, no other injuries?
No, he had a pre-existing traumatic brain injury, and he had a pre-existing brachial plexus injury from another accident. Our client was not wearing a helmet. So bad brain injury, no helmet. It would have been a unanimous jury. Well, depends on who the other juror would have been. But 5 out of the 6 jurors were 100% against Tesla. And 3 out of the 6 jurors were all over 100 million. The 4-person was at 70 million. But the one juror that held the verdict down and the one juror that pushed for the 30% comparative fault verdict against Chris, our client, was a motorcyclist, or a woman who claimed she was a motorcyclist and came from a motorcycle family, who said in voir dire that the helmet was irrelevant. The helmet has nothing to do with the case. I didn't want her on the jury, but my gut told me we had to have her off. She ended up on the jury. We had some really tough choices to make. And the jurors get to deliberate in Indiana as the case goes on. So in between witnesses on breaks, they get to deliberate and talk about the case. And all throughout, she kept saying, even though in jury selection, she said, the helmet's irrelevant. That has nothing to do with this case. She kept saying, well, I just wish he was wearing his helmet. We wear helmets in our family, going on and on and on. She was horrible. She lied to get on the jury. And I've talked to the 4-person, and I've gone over the trial in depth. She was awful. She was awful and said things that were untrue to get onto that jury, which we've been seeing now. We have Donald Trump who lies. We have people out there that lie and they get away with it. It used to be, I mean, remember Bill Clinton and he lied? Boy, that was it with him. Now people lie and they get away with it. They lie and they stick to their lie.
You know, it's like the Trump thing. He's saying he lies and he broke the law. People are like, everybody does that. You know what I mean? Everybody lies. Why is he, they're picking on him.
But look at the other things that he's done. You got to be kidding me. 20 years ago, if a presidential candidate got caught in a lie, they're done. They're done. Look at John Edwards.
Right? I know. Who is it? John Edwards. There was, I think even John Kerry, when he was making his presidential thing with the squid, they swift-voted him. It wasn't even a lie. They just repackaged what he said. And it just destroyed his career or his opportunity to run for president. So it's crazy. Let me ask you, what did you demand prior to the final demand? I know your demands escalate as time goes up. You raise those demands. I mean, your settlement opportunity. What was your...
Oh, yeah. The settlement opportunities. So Tesla had an opportunity to settle for $10 million, then $15 million, then $20 million, then $22 million, ignored all the settlement opportunities, and it went up from there. And then at some point, I sent him a thing, just said, you're going to have to pay $100 million to settle this case. And I sent out emails challenging Alex Spiro, Musk's personal lawyer, who was pro-hawked into the case, to show up for trial, and he didn't show up for trial. I wanted to try this case. I didn't want to settle it after they blew the opportunities. But after closing argument on damages, Tesla came to us and said, listen, if you give us a number under $10 million, we'll make some phone calls and see if we can get the case settled. And that's the best we got from Tesla. If you give us a number under 10, we'll make some calls and see what we can do. So I never saw an offer on the case, not a single penny of an offer from Tesla.
Well, that makes your decision easier.
Yeah.
So when you stand up for voir dire, tell us about the key issues that you thought you needed to talk to that Indiana jury about prior to deciding whether you thought they were going to be appropriate for your case.
How do they feel about motorcycles, right? People getting on motorcycles. I can tell you how Courtney Rowley feels about motorcycles. She made me get rid of all of mine. You remember my Harleys?
I remember driving your motorcycle.
I love that. I know you always wanted to get on the back and ride. And I'm like, Dan, all right, I'll give you one ride. No, I don't think you're ever on the back of my motorcycle. But she said, you're getting rid of those things. I'm not going to marry you and have kids with you if you're riding motorcycles. We've seen what happens to people on motorcycles through no fault of their own. Right? Bad things happen. Someone pulls out in front of you or someone broadsides you on a motorcycle. It's going to be way worse than if you're driving in a car. So I had to talk to jurors about that and find out, is there anyone out here who's going to have a tendency or just a leaning towards putting Chris Dugan at fault just for making the choice to be on a motorcycle? And got a lot of people talking about that, and people were brutally honest. We had some jurors give us everything we needed for a cause challenge. And then I threw out the fact that he wasn't wearing a motorcycle helmet. Some people came out of their skin about that. And then the law in Indiana is that that can't impact the verdict in any way, shape, or form. That doesn't dock the damages. That doesn't impact liability. That's a fact in this case that can't be used in any way to reduce the amount of the verdict that Chris gets if we win the case. And we had jurors give us everything we needed to get them off for cause because they couldn't do that. And then the other thing was money damages, non-economic damages, making clear that non-economic damages, the human value of what happened to Chris, the human losses, the pain, the suffering, the loss of enjoyment of life, the permanent disfigurement, that was the biggest part of this case. And to find out which jurors had feelings, had attitudes that were adverse to money verdicts for non-economic damages. Now, how do you feel? There are some folks that say, you know, if it's money for medical bills or for lost earnings, I'm fine with being a juror in a case like that, no matter how large those numbers are. But if you're talking about money for pain and suffering and loss of enjoyment of life, I hear millions or tens of millions of dollars for something like that. And that goes against the grain of who I am and what I believe. Is that your truth? Anyone? And people talk about it. That bothers them. And if you read in the newspaper, you know, you see there's a civil lawsuit and a person was awarded tens of millions of dollars for pain and suffering, not medical bills or lost earnings. Some folks out there that'll go, what the heck? Another one of these big out of control jury verdicts and put the paper down. There are other people that be neutral. And other people might say, wow, I wonder what evidence that jury heard to justify a verdict like that. Where would you fall? And talk to the different jurors about that.
And you started out your voir dire with
gratitude.
So tell us about that.
I was very grateful. When you've waited so long to get to trial on a case, when you've seen the people you represent devastated each time the defense gets a continuance, when those jurors walk in the room that actually responded to their jury summons, that's beautiful. That's special. I was filled with such gratitude for every juror, even the bad one that ended up on our jury. I was filled with joy and gratitude that now I'd have the opportunity to present Chris's case and that he would see justice.
The feeling of gratitude, but then when you stand up, is the first thing you talk about brutal honesty?
After expressing gratitude in that case, I was very thankful. So I expressed my gratitude and asked him to please be talkative in the way that I do. And then I went to brutal honesty.
So for those potential people who are listening to this, who haven't ever heard you talk about brutal honesty, maybe you want to kind of tell us how that particular, because you really made that brutal honesty voir dire sort of like your trademark in this weird sort of way, because they existed. Brutal, those two words existed and the concept existed before you.
Yeah, I had never heard brutal honesty, those two words used together before. And it was back in, I think it was 2006. In Du Bois, Wyoming, at the ranch where I was going through voir dire and practicing my jury selection skills, where I came up with and I wrote down brutal honesty and I put it in trial by him and I started using it in trials. And now I hear brutal honesty everywhere. So it's one thing, one of the few things that the main thing that I take credit for.
That you've contributed to the plaintiff's bar.
You know, judges are doing it. The defense lawyer in Monsanto was doing it. In voir dire last week, and I brought it up. The judge, I said, see, you like brutal honesty. And I said, where'd you learn that? To tell the judge the truth. You read my book. It's okay. Got all bent out of shape. But judges use it, and it really works. It really works. Gets people talking.
It's a real useful tool for a lot of people, because for a lot of people, for most lawyers, voir dire is the hardest and most difficult part of the trial, and yet the most important, and yet we don't want to practice it. Just hope it comes to them by some type of osmosis, this ability to communicate to the jury. It's an interesting technique.
The important thing about brutal honesty is that it's not yours, it's theirs. So when you get the promise from the jurors to talk to you, and you've asked them politely to be talkative, then you test that and you put it into action with brutal honesty. So if you're, you know, sitting there with a jury, good morning, thank you for being here, whatever else I'm saying, I'm hoping that somehow you will all become some of the most talkative people that have ever been in this courtroom. This is the opportunity to get to know as much as we can about you, and the time for us to make a decision, and importantly, for you to make a decision within yourself about whether or not you are the right juror for this case, or if you have a bias that might impact your ability to be fair and impartial, or an attitude or a belief. So this is the time to talk. And the way I was raised is, if you need something from somebody, is to ask them directly and to ask them politely. So will you please do your best to be very talkative and to talk to me and the court and even the other lawyers who are against me here? Mr. Ambrose?
I will. I'll do my best.
Thank you. There's a topic. There's a room filled with silence as maybe a cue to get things going. Could I just say, will someone please talk to me? Is that all right?
That's all right.
Okay. I might check in with a few other jurors, take a breath. Now it's time to move on to something else. Let's see if this works. That's what I'm thinking in my mind. I'm filled with gratitude because these jurors, they've promised, they've told me, they've given me their word that they're going to be talkative. That feels great. They're going to help me do my job. Brutal honesty. What do the words brutal honesty mean to you? What do those words mean to you? Will someone please talk to me?
Saying like it is, telling it like it is, even if it hurts.
Thank you, Mr. Ambrose. Who else? Yeah, I'm using my eyes. I'm looking at jurors. Now we're testing. Are they really going to talk to me? And I use brutal honesty to do that. And then as we go through, it depends on how much time you have. If you have unlimited voir dire, then you might go through most of the jurors. Thank you. Please be brutally honest with whatever we're talking about. This is the time to make the decision about who should be on this jury. And it would be really awful for the person I represent or for the defense to find out at the end of this trial that the case went a certain way because we had a juror or jurors that came into this case with a lens of bias or a filter of bias or something that made them better for one side versus the other. It'd be awful at the end of the trial, you know, one of us says, hey, why'd the case turn out that way? And one of the jurors says, well, you should have never had me on this jury. I have a loved one who works in healthcare. I have a bias in favor of healthcare professionals. So I really held you to a higher standard of proof. And sorry, I was kind of favoring the defense to begin with. Or I have a loved one who is a victim of malpractice. So this was my opportunity to help somebody out because I couldn't help my loved one. Then we wouldn't be winning the case. And we do expect to win with the evidence, but fair and square, not because we got people onto this jury that were already favoring our side and giving us an unfair advantage over the defense. Does that make sense, Mr. Ambrose?
Yes, it does.
Thank you. Is there anyone that feels that way? Now we just start talking. You might just say, you think you'd be who thinks they'd be a good juror on this case? Who here would say, it might be difficult for me? Might be difficult for me. And just get them talking. And love them for doing so, no matter what they say. They say something that's awful and rude, you'd be grateful and love that person because they're saying it now, not back in the jury room after having been sworn in as a member of your jury.
Right. I think that's going to be real helpful for people just listening to you put together like that. I know it has for me, just thinking about it and thinking about that next jury selection, somebody I'm helping prepare, like I'm going down to see Tim Felice. I'm leaving here in 3 hours to head down to West Palm Beach. He's trying cases left and right and getting some.
He's a good trialer, man, and he is just going at it.
Oh, no. And he even got himself a plane like you, see? He's like, real trial lawyers have their own planes. I'm like, yes, they do, Tim. Where are we going?
Planes help you get to more places quicker, more efficiently to help more people.
That is my goal, to get a plane too in a couple more years so I can be more efficient. Keep working real hard and saving my quarters up for eventually. Let me ask you a little bit more about that case though. And that the opening statement, because you had all these issues that you talked about, the helmet, the sun in the eye stuff and all these issues. So when you thought about that opening statement and the issue of comparative fault, because I know that after the big data studies here, no matter what you did, they were putting 30% on your plaintiff. So I know you were not thrilled with those numbers and wanted to beat the data. So tell us about your opening, you know, how you thought about your opening statement and what you wanted to accomplish by the time you got done with your, because that was an hour and a half. It was a very, very in-depth length opening statement, like an hour and a half. And it was a bifurcated trial just on liability. Serious forensic review.
Yeah, I took too long in that opening statement. I was angry. I didn't let the anger show, but it was in me. Demonstrative that I had planned to use during opening statement. The opening statement would have probably been 40 minutes had I been able to use that. They objected the last minute and the judge said I couldn't use that. And a bunch of slides that were, you know, still shots of that demonstrative. So then I had to use the courtroom and turn the courtroom into the scene of the collision. And it took me more time. And I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to win this case in opening. I'm going to destroy them before they even stand up. And so I took a long time working to do that and trying to calm myself down and stay calm during that process. So I watched that opening and I think, boy, I could have been way more efficient. I had rehearsed the opening, jury selection and the opening on Saturday and Sunday. So I walked in on Monday and I had to do a different opening than that which I had prepared and rehearsed.
Let me just sidetrack for a second. You've done, what, over 100 civil jury trials? How many would you guess?
178.
178. You're like roughly 178. Not that I'm counting. Just, it's me being funny, but apparently it's missing on you. But the thing is, even after 177 jury trials, getting ready for this one, you still did a focus group to practice your voir dire in your opening 2 days in a row.
Absolutely. This is an important case. Absolutely. I make the time and Saturday and Sunday before trial, I'm able to. That's usually what I do.
And what is the benefit of that for you, even with all your experience?
That was the third case I had tried in a 3-month period. Well, in 5 weeks, I tried three cases in three different states. And I had to shift gears. I was in a different place. I just wanted to make sure that when I got into trial, also I was upset about this case, so I needed to calm myself down a bit, which, you know, again, I got riled up because I wasn't able to use what I intended to use in my opening. It's the right thing to do. You're going to find things. I know that with the focus groups, I found some things that I needed to say and found out that some of the things I was going to say weren't going to work that well. So I added some things, I cut some things out, and I was ready. I was prepared. You know, if you're going to go into a boxing ring or a cage and fight, you're going to warm up and you're going to do some drills before the fight. You're not just going to sit around and do nothing. You got to get yourself pumped up. Got to get the wheels greased. You roll right in.
Got it. You rolled in and your hour and a half opening. But my question was, when you were done, you were just trying to win that trial in that opening statement.
Trying to win that case in opening statement. That's right. Which I've done many times in my career. But I don't think that winning your case in opening is the way to win a case right now. I think giving the jurors information, being very neutral, is the right way to go. And let the defense get up and spend the rest of the trial destroying their credibility. But don't try to sell your case in opening statement. You don't need to. We live in a world now where everybody is skeptical about and questions everything. Used to be you'd get up and you'd say something good. It has credibility and people accept it. Now, man, as you're talking, people are rejecting what you're saying. Human beings don't get their information from the same sources, not even within their own families. Everything's scrambled right now. I think that makes Russia and China pretty happy that that's what's going on in the United States. We're all taking the bait. What do you listen to? Don't answer, but where do you get your news and your information versus where do I get mine? It's probably not the same place. I might get something that's going to say something completely opposite to that which you are reading.
So you're not tuning into InfoWars on a daily basis is what you're telling me?
I don't even know what that is.
Alex Jones, the psychopath.
I read The Atlantic, The New York Times.
As do I. I don't read The Atlantic, but I read The New York Times.
But I won't listen to anything on Fox News. And there might be some truths on Fox News, but I won't listen to it.
Look at that. See, they're more in common than we do. Me too. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So, Nick, we're going to So we'll talk about one other topic here. Well, actually, the webinar that we did a couple of weeks ago, if you missed it, it's on TLU On Demand. And if you don't have TLU On Demand, if you shoot me an email, dan@triallawyersuniversity.com, I'll send you a 1 month comp code for it. So you can check out Nick's webinar and other things. He's got quite a few. There's a presentation with you and Gary Dordick from 2022 when you guys did a live voir dire in Vegas.
Yeah.
And then did a few other webinars during the pandemic. So that's all there. But you and I were involved a couple of years back. Nick and I happened to be involved in the same lawsuit for different purposes. And because I got sued by the Trial Lawyers College because they thought people were confused between Trial Lawyers College and Trial Lawyers University. Well, that's what they alleged.
They alleged that you started Trial Lawyers University to confuse people with the Trial Lawyers College, which had split up. There's now the Trial Lawyers College and there's the Jerry Spence Method, and they're both teaching and they're teaching people well. And they have their own programs, and I hope everybody on both sides is doing well. But they sued you and alleged that you were part of some conspiracy. There were a bunch of allegations against you, and none of them were true. None of them were true. You started Trial Lawyers University during the pandemic, and you were able to reach so many lawyers that were would otherwise have had no legal education during the pandemic. And you unified trial lawyers from all over the country to become a part of TLU. And you did something, Dan, that's so great and so outstanding. And I'm so proud of you for it. I'm so proud of you knowing you, you know, almost 20 years, what you did with putting Trial Lawyers University together. And you've been so dedicated for so long as I've known you, to helping other lawyers learn. So you put this beautiful thing together and you had a lawsuit filed against you. And I don't think it's because there was malintent. I think it's because they believed that's what had happened, because some of the people on one side of the litigation between, you know, Jerry Spence's group of people and the other side thought you were on one side and you weren't. And some of those people had spoke on your platform when it first started. So you got pulled into this ugly mess. And I came in with Jacob Norman, my partner, and your longtime friend, and we defended you in that case. And we did it pro bono, even though you offered to pay us, we wouldn't take it because we felt you were being bullied.
I still remember I was on my way. You know, I was pulling up to, I think when you called me about that, I think I was pulling up to Mike Alder's house for some type of, I think, I just remember it just so weird, like, because that's, I think that's what it was. And we hadn't talked in a while. And I was real, because like, these lawsuits are expensive. And especially when you deal with somebody that has like Trial Lawyers College, that's truly, they have unlimited funds because they're getting so much in donations to spend on legal fees. It's like Trump has unlimited funds to spend on legal fees.
I wouldn't say that either side of that litigation, you know, yeah, you'd be in the middle of it. I don't think either side had unlimited funds. I don't. I think it was really ugly mess between a lot of good people on both sides. And it was just an ugly divorce and breakup. I think everything's done with that now. And people are doing their own thing, but it was really ugly. It was a civil war between trial lawyers, you know, all across the country that were on one side or the other. It was very ugly. I'm glad it's done and over with.
That makes two of us. That makes two of us. It was a little bit of a burden thinking about it, operating.
You know what? The Trial Lawyers College and the Spence Method have instructors on both sides who are teaching at each other's programs. Everyone's being kind to one another. We successfully put an end to it all, you know, with people on both sides working hard to accomplish that. So civility exists again in our national community of trial lawyers. We should compliment everybody on both sides because divorces can be ugly. And then when people settle things down and they do what's right, especially for the children and the other people involved,
right,
it's the right thing to do. So good job, everybody. Good job to Joey Lowe, Jerry Spence, everybody on that side. Good job to John Sloan, who's the president of the Trial Lawyers College, and all the great people over there. Good job.
So here's my last question before we wrap this up, Nick. You've been at this for roughly 20 years now. So what would you say is your, for yourself, your proudest accomplishment professionally? I know you're a big family guy, but your proudest accomplishment professionally, what would you say it is? Because I know you have a few things. I know you have, because like I just know of. I don't even know of all your life. I know you helped resolve that conflict with Spence and all those people. And you have other things that you've done that are rather significant with the MedMail stuff in California and significant verdicts. And so what would you say it is as you search your 20 years of doing this, the thing that makes you smile when you think about it?
It's been, we're going into May, so it'll be 22 years of practicing as a lawyer. Got some, a lot of wrinkles here. Sometimes they more wrinkly on one day versus the next, being down here in Costa Rica in this humid air. So 22 years of doing it, and then 2 years as a certified law student. What I'm proud of is trying an average of 10 cases per year throughout my entire career, except during the time period that we were in COVID. I tried cases during COVID with a mask. It was the most awful thing ever. But continuing to try, I mean, 1 year I tried 15 cases, is trying so many cases, all types of cases, and consistently doing that and motivating other lawyers to get out there and try cases. I could say that helping change the $250,000 cap in California was one of the things I'm most proud of. And I'm very proud of that. And there were a lot of people that were a part of that. We're doing that work in other states to fight tort reform. That fight continues. I'm involved, heavily involved in multiple states right now, fighting those battles. But the thing I'm most proud of is helping other lawyers find the courage and develop the skills to try cases, teaching and continuing to teach and have a passion for it.
That is so exciting, isn't it? When you help somebody and they find their voice and they find their courage to go and do something they've never done before, and they have all this insecurity and fear that we all experience, and they find it within themselves to find the courage and within the fear, and push themselves and discipline themselves to, because people have no idea how hard it is being a plaintiff's lawyer to work months on a case and put hundreds of thousands, if not $1 million, and not know and what's going to happen. Especially early, you know, a lot of folks early in their career, they're going to get punched in the face a lot because there's just so much going on in that courtroom. Until you've been there a few times, you can't even begin to fathom it. So it is a great thing to teach.
And having the courage to get back up when we're knocked down, now when we're beaten and bloodied, laying there, we just want it to all end. You know, finding the courage and the strength to get back up and get in the ring again. That's what it really takes. Being a real trial lawyer doesn't mean you're winning all the time. Real trial lawyers lose cases because they try tough cases.
I know, you know, you have these great victories, but the three trials that you tried the last 5 weeks, one of them didn't go your way.
Lost. Right? Yeah, got
And that, especially for you, as much confidence you may have, it's still a ding in the armor. It still fucks with your head.
I had people saying, why are you going to try that case? Why are you trying that case? Why are you doing it? You know, you're that, excuse me? Why?
Why?
If I get to a point to where cases are just beneath me or not big enough for me, then I'm a fraud. And I've turned into that which I have resented. That which I look at and say, come on. You're a great trialer. Get back into the trenches, get into the mud, get dirty and fight some tough cases. And all the great trial lawyers out there who I know, Brian Panish, Gary Dordick, could go on and on, Rosh Hamampour, Carney Shigarian, David D. Robertus, and keep going and going and going. Joe Freed, I could list out all the lawyers that are in my brain, Keith Mitnick, Rick Friedman, they try tough cases and sometimes they lose. Because they're real. They're real trial lawyers. And those are the people we should look up to. And every one of them could just pick and choose what they try.
Or they never have to try a case again if they don't want to. They were just in pursuit of the money. None of them. Nobody would be back in that court with those people that you mentioned. It's about something bigger.
It's about something bigger.
Well, Nick, I appreciate you visiting with us from Costa Rica. And I look forward to seeing you in Huntington Beach in one capacity or another. Hopefully in the flesh, but we'll see. And I look forward to the next 6 months because we're going to do some really cool shit together to help people get better throughout this country between these programs. We got going in your trial by human programs to get people together. I know a lot of people were excited to go to Montana. They're out in Santa Barbara. They're already making their plans and stuff. So it's so great, the community. I just love the community and seeing people that you're friends when you get together besides learning.
Well, you've built a big one that's connected so many of us, Dan, and I'm proud to be part of it.
Well, thanks. I'm looking forward to it. And good luck in that trial. And we'll be touching base and definitely in the middle of it in June.
All right, brother.
Take care.
See you all soon. Bye-bye.
Ready to train with the Titans and set records with your verdicts? Register for our live conferences and boot camps at triallawyersuniversity.com. Start getting your reps in before the big event by going to tluondemand.com to gain instant access to live lectures, case analysis, and skills training videos from the trial lawyer champions you love and respect, as well as pleadings, transcripts, PowerPoints, and notes for a roadmap to victory. Join the group that continues to get extraordinary results. Trial Lawyers University, produced and powered by LawPods.